Well, we're in 2 Samuel, session 7, chapters 19, 20, and 21. We're going to deal here, of course, with David's return. Absalom's rebellion has been squelched. Absalom himself has been killed. And we're now going to see the problems that face David as he attempts to reestablish his authority over the kingdom. With the disarray in David's family, not only Saul's descendants as one group, and also the northern tribes as another that were loyal to Absalom, but now Absalom, that squelched, they're sort of at sea here. So there's still a lot of political issues in the air as we go forward. So let's turn to 2 Samuel chapter 19, verse 1. And it was told Joab, "Behold, the king weepeth and mourneth for Absalom." And the victory that day, they had a huge victory, of course, against Absalom. The victory that day was turned into mourning unto all the people. For the people heard say that day how the king was grieved for his son. Now, see, David's elation at having regained the kingdom through all this is undercut, of course, by his despair that he lost his son. Verse 3, "And the people got them by stealth that day into the city as people being ashamed steal away when they flee in battle." See, in other words, instead of coming back joyous, they had this huge victory. They're slipping into town dejected because the king is more upset with his son being killed than the fact that this terrifying rebellion has been squashed. They had a tremendous victory here. So this, of course, you can imagine how that would affect David's soldiers. They've got to be very chagrined. You know, they've risked their lives for the king. And here he seems to have, you get the impression he would have preferred losing the battle and keeping his son or something somehow. That's sort of the impression that he's creating. Anyway, in verse 4, "But the king covered his face and the king cried with a loud voice, 'Oh, my son Absalom, oh, Absalom, my son, my son.'" This was a very customary way of expressing grief. The muffled head and so forth shut one away from the external world, and it certainly depressed the people around him because they felt that the king may have wished that he might die and be with Absalom and so forth. Now, in a sense, by the way, some scholars point out that the covered head of David symbolized the shroud of Absalom's burial. Veils worn by mourning widows tracks back to that kind of a custom. Anyway, let's go on to verse 5. "And Joab came into the house to the king and said, 'Thou hast shamed this day the faces of all thy servants, which this day have saved thy life and the lives of thy sons and of thy daughters and the lives of thy wives and the lives of thy concubines.'" See, Joab's taking David to task here. "And in that thou lovest thine enemies and hatest thy friends. For thou hast declared this day that thou regardest neither princes nor servants, for this day I perceive that if Absalom had lived and all we had died this day, then it would have pleased thee well." Which is obviously not true, but Joab is making his point that David's giving a very, very dangerous, unsavory impression here. "Now therefore arise, go forth and speak comfortably unto thy servants, for I swear by the Lord, if thou go not forth, there will not tarry one with thee this night. And that will be worse unto thee than all the evil that befell thee from thy youth until now." Now, Joab, of course, was a guy that had known frustration before of doing the right thing, only to have the king turn it against him back in chapter 3 and 14 and elsewhere. But he confronted David and rebuked him for his insensitivity towards his own officers and all the people, actually. He's telling David to appear before the troops and assure them that he appreciated their selfless service to him. Now, that's on the one hand, Joab is absolutely right. On the other hand, Joab also is a disciplined militarian and probably it hinders him understanding the grief that David felt for a father for his son. David, of course, is viewing these events just in terms of his personal needs because of his loss of his son, Absalom. The real problem that Joab is highlighting here is consequences more serious than Absalom's rebellion might follow if the mob was stirred to anger by the king's lack of appreciation for their bravery on his behalf. A rebellion you can deal with, but a general anarchy is a much more difficult thing. Verse 8, "Then the king arose and sat in the gate, and they told unto all the people, saying, 'Behold, the king doth sit in the gate.' And all the people came before the king, for Israel had fled, every man to his tent. And all the people were at strife throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, the king saved us out of the hand of our enemies, and he delivered us out of the hand of the Philistines, and now he has fled out of the land for Absalom. See, the short-lived rebellion had not gained its objective. Discontent continues throughout the land. This movement to restore David to power was not unanimous. See, some felt that he had lost his right to rule. Others looked at him as having the right to rule because of past service, but there's certainly strife. Absalom, whom we anointed over us, is dead in battle. Now, therefore, why speak ye not a word of bringing the king back? And King David sent to Zadok and Abiathar, those are the two priests, you remember he set up, saying, speak unto the elders of Judah, saying, why are ye the last to bring the king back to his house, seeing the speech of all Israel has come to the king, even to his house? You would think that the tribes of Judah, because that's where David hailed from, would be the first to really welcome him back. So they're trying to get them on track here. The elders of Judah, these are the men who could help win the tribe back to the cause of David. And they were reticent to do so. Partly because they played a prominent part in the insurrection. That's one reason that David commissioned the two priests, Zadok and Abiathar, to make an appeal to Judah through the tribal leaders. And so we get to verse 12. And ye are my brethren, ye are my bones and my flesh, wherefore then are ye the last to bring back the king? And say ye to a man... Oh, now, one other thing here. The total message is here. This is just a very brief summary. There's obviously much longer speeches made by these delegates. What most commentators assume is that they also probably hinted that there might be a movement started to make a northern city the capital instead of Jerusalem. See, if Judah moves, they'll keep their capital, of course, there in the region of Judah. You remember, David had moved his capital from Hebron to Jerusalem. He could move it back as part of the threat. So anyway, verse 13. Interesting, strange decision is made here. He says, and say ye to Amasa, art thou not bone of my bone and of my flesh? God do so to me and more also. If thou be not captain of the host before me continually in the room of Joab. Apparently, to help get support from the tribe of Judah, he told the priest to promise Amasa, who was really a nephew of David, that he would succeed Joab as commander of the army. This may not have been a very wise idea even on the outset, because Joab was David's nephew through a half-sister, if you may recall. And he probably now had been completely discredited in David's eyes because of his open disagreements with David's policies on several places here. On the other hand, he should welcome that you have a voice of dissent on the staff. On the other hand, it's always with risk on the part of that person. Now, this move to give Amasa Joab's job could be a masterstroke in terms of military policy to secure the loyalty of the army, but By doing so, he also demoted Joab, probably motivated in part by his murder of Absalom. And so some commentators feel it was a big mistake, and it turns out to be quickly rectified by Joab in any case. But the other thing here, there's no reason to believe that the loyalty of Amasa had been proved. So it's a very strange maneuver, strictly politically motivated. So he bowed the heart of all the men of Judah, verse 14, even as the heart of one man, so that they sent this word unto the king, return thou and all thy servants. So the king returned and came to Jordan. And Judah came to Gilgal to go to meet the king and to conduct the king over the Jordan. So this is the big return. This is the big move here. And now we run into this guy Shimei again. And Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, which was of Behurim, hasted and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. And there were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him, and Ziba the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons, and his 20 servants with him, and they went over Jordan before the king. And they went over a ferry boat to carry over the king's household and to do what he thought good. And Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king as he was come over Jordan. Now, this is the guy, you recall, that was cursing and throwing rocks at David, and Abiathar wanted to kill him, and David wouldn't let him curse, remember? Of course, now his cause is somewhat emptied, and he comes now seeking forgiveness, one would assume. Shimei is even more peril now than before, so he prostrates himself before the king. And Shimei says to the king, let not my lord impute iniquity unto me, neither do thou remember that which thy servant did perversely, the day that my lord the king went out of Jerusalem. that the king should take it to his heart. For thy servant doth know that I have sinned, and therefore, behold, I am come the first this day of all the house of Joseph to go down to meet my lord the king. That house of Joseph may sound like a strange phrase, but you see, ten tribes, other than Judah and Benjamin, of the ten tribes, they were distinguished from Judah by the label of the most powerful among them, which of course is Ephraim, the son of Joseph. And with Manasseh would be considered this house of Joseph. So it's an idiom really being used here for the whole northern group of tribes. And Abishai, he's the guy that wanted to kill him the last time, remember? Abishai, the son of Zeruiah. Remember now, Abishai was a son of Zeruiah who married Jesse, David's father, having already had the son. So these sons of Zeruiah is always a strange phrase, but it emphasized that on the one hand, they're in the family in a sense, but they're still not sons of David directly, you follow me? Anyway, Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, answered and said, "Shall not Shimei be put to death for this, because he cursed the Lord's anointed?" So he's after him again. It's the second time. David said, "What have I to do with you, ye sons of Zeruiah, that ye should this day be adversaries unto me? Shall there any man be put to death this day in Israel? For do not I know that I am this day the king over Israel?" Therefore the king said unto Shimei, "Thou shalt not die." And the king sware unto him. That's a little incomplete, because David will have Solomon deal with Shimei. He doesn't instruct Solomon to kill Shimei, but he wants Solomon to even the score. So Solomon sets up a stage that if Shimei does one thing wrong, he's had it. And he knows sooner or later he's going to do that one thing wrong, and he does get it. So that'll all come up, obviously, later. But so Shimei will get his before it's all over. But it's to David's credit that he deferred that whole thing. Now Mephibosheth, remember his servant had come, Ziba had come to David and implied that Mephibosheth had thrown his lot with Absalom, which was apparently not true. It's slander, we find out. And you remember at that time, David gave all of the wealth or inheritance to Ziba the servant. But now Mephibosheth comes to the son of Saul. He came down to meet the king and had neither dressed his feet nor trimmed his beard nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he came again in peace. That's a sign of his mourning. That's a sign of his repentance. His neglect of appearance is just an outward sign of grief, in effect. That's the tone of what's going on here. In verse 25, "And it came to pass when he was come to Jerusalem to meet the king, that the king said unto him, Wherefore wentest not thou with me, Mephibosheth?" In other words, he apparently threw his lot in with Absalom when Absalom was on the rise. "And he," that's Mephibosheth, "said, My lord, O king, my servant deceived me, for thy servant said, I will saddle me an ass that I may ride thereon and go to the king, because thy servant is lame. And he hath slandered thy servant unto my lord the king. But my lord the king is as an angel of God. Do therefore what is good in thine eyes." So Mephibosheth is protesting, in effect, to David that his servant had lied about him. He's arguing that Saul's grandson, who, he is, had not tried to use the occasion to bring his grandfather's dynasty back into control. See, the presumption is that Mephibosheth would be among those that would be trying to reestablish Saul in the absence of David's leadership. And he goes on, "For all my father's house were but dead men before my lord the king. Yet didst thou set thy servant among them that did eat at thine own table. What right therefore have I yet to cry any more unto the king?" And the king said unto him, "Why speakest thou any more of these matters? I have said, Thou and Ziba divide the land." So what he's done here, the way he resolves this issue, it's not clear whether David believes him or not, but he splits the difference and takes what the inheritance and divides it between Ziba and Mephibosheth. Different commentators take slightly different perspectives of what might have been going on here. What's true or not can't really be determined, but it seems David at least was somewhat convinced by Mephibosheth to return half of the estate that he previously had threatened to withdraw from him. And so in verse 30, Mephibosheth said unto the king, "Yea." Now let me back up. If you remember, Mephibosheth was the one that was lame since a child. David, as he gets to power, finds out that Jonathan had a son. He speaks of Saul as his son, but it's really as his father. It's really his grandfather. Mephibosheth is the son of Jonathan, and because of David's love for Jonathan, he saw to it that Mephibosheth was well taken care of. In Absalom's rebellion, Mephibosheth's servant implies that Mephibosheth has sided with Absalom. That's the slander that he was trying to use for his own gain. Well, Mephibosheth here is trying to straighten out. And it's clear that David at least is partially convinced because he returns half the estate to Mephibosheth in any case. Mephibosheth said to the king, yeah, let him take all for as much as my lord the king has come again in peace unto his own house. Now there's another guy here, Barzillai the Gileadite, came down from Rogalim and went over Jordan with the king to conduct him over the Jordan. Now Barzillai was a very aged, remember we talked about him last time too. He was very aged man, even 80 years, in other words, 80 years old. And he had provided the king substance, remember at that critical time when he was on flight, while he lay at Menahem. And he was a very great man. King said unto Barzillai, come thou over with me, and I will feed thee with me in Jerusalem. In other words, now that we're on the wind, come on with me and you know, take part of the spoil, so to speak. But Barzillai said to the king, how long have I to live that I should go up with the king unto Jerusalem? I am this day 80 years old. And can I discern between good and evil? Can thy servant taste what I eat or what I drink? Can I hear any more the voice of singing men and singing women? Wherefore then should I, thy servant, be a yet a burden unto my lord the king? Thy servant will go a little way over the Jordan with the king, and why should the king recompense me with such a reward? Let thy servant, I pray thee, turn back again, that I may die in mine own city, and be buried by the grave of my father and of my mother. But behold, thy servant Chimham, let him go over with thy lord the king, and do to him what shall seem good unto thee. So basically he's wants just to live out his days in peace, not join the pressures that he'll encounter in Jerusalem. Ask that Chimham, his might have been his son, we don't know that, go in his place and be rewarded. And of course David accommodates him. Josephus, I believe, is the source of the possibility that Chimham was Barzillai's son. But in any case, you get to verse 38. The king answered, Chimham shall go over with me, and I will do to him that which shall seem good unto thee, and whatsoever thou shalt require of me, that will I do for thee. And all the people went over the Jordan, and the king was come over, and the king kissed Barzillai, blessed him, and he returned unto his place. He's getting the attention here because his resources assisted David when he had to flee Jerusalem back in Absalom's rebellion, if you recall. So he's getting, that's why he's getting rewarded here. And the king went over to Gilgal, and King Ham went on with him, and all the people of Judah conducted the king, and also half the people of Israel. And behold, all the men of Israel came to the king and said unto the king, why have our brethren of men of Judah stolen thee away and have brought the king and his household and all of David's men with him over the Jordan? The northern kingdom, the northern tribes, they're both involved here. The men of Israel, but they're using that term in the denotative sense, in the sense of the northern tribes. They're upset because the Judeans are claiming David as one of their own to the exclusion of the other tribes. There's some rivalry going on between Judah, from which David hails, and the other northern kingdom. So there's going to be some discussion here. And all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, because the king is near of kin to us. Wherefore then be ye angry for this matter? Have we eaten all the king's cost? Or hath he given us any gift? And the men of Israel, the northern kingdom people, answered the men of Judah and said, we have 10 parts in the king, and we have also more right in David than ye. Why then did ye despise us that our advice should not be the first had in bringing back our king? And the words of men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel. So the two factions are squabbling over who is more supportive of the king. And this you're going to see here, you see it already here, but you're going to see it intensify. There is bad feeling between the northern tribes and they keep saying Judah, but Judah and Benjamin are together in this. So if you think of them as Judah and Benjamin as the southern tribes and the other 10, the northern part, there's a division of attitude. You know, we find this locally, in the colloquial. I can't speak to the politics here, but in California, for an example, if you're from Southern California or from Northern California, you think you're from two different states. And you can find other parallels. It's very analogous. And this division, though, in this case, is going to get deeper and deeper so that when Solomon dies, there's literally going to be a civil war and they will split, literally split. But you can already see in the politics, even coming through the text, that it's already started here back in 2 Samuel 19. And so on. So, see, the Judeans are saying that David is from their tribe, but the northern tribe saying there are 10 tribes of them, and therefore their claim carries more weight. That's their argument. But they also say that they were the first to insist that David return to rule over the nation. By the way, their claim there has some basis in the narrative, if you go back and look at verses 9 and 10 and so forth. But the argument also reveals the fickleness of the people, because they were also the first to support the rebellion of Absalom. And so And so now they're the first to clamor to get David back. But this depth of division here will be a theme forthcoming. So ends chapter 19. Let's go to chapter 20, where David now is going to try to reestablish his authority. There happened to be there a man of Belial, whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. And he blew a trumpet and said, "We have no part in David, neither have we inheritance in the son of Jesse, every man to his tents, O Israel." This guy is a worthless son of a family of Becher. He's a second son of Benjamin. Of course, remember now, Benjamin was the tribe from which Saul came. There's another faction of disenfranchised people that feel an allegiance to the previous king Saul. So there's a tension between the Benjamites and the Judahites in the sense of the house of Saul and the house of David. And he's trying to wrest the power away from Judah and regaining it for Benjamin. When he says, "Every man to his tents, O Israel," he's employing the words used in the successful rebellion by Jeroboam the first, which will come later. The meaning really is, "Men, let's turn in our uniforms and K-rations and return to the farms. And I'll head up a resistance group to better secure portions for us all." In other words, he's saying, leave this, and he's really organizing a counter-resistance movement underground, presumably. "So every man of Israel went up from after David and followed Sheba the son of Bichri, and all the men of Judah clave to their king from Jordan even to Jerusalem." So again, you see the division continuing here. "And David came to his house at Jerusalem, and the king took 10 women, his concubines." Remember, these are the 10 that Absalom publicly took on the rooftop to make a point. It was his way of demonstrating he had power and that he was in control of the royal resources. Anyway, these 10 were David's concubines. He took these 10 women. They're the ones he had left in Jerusalem to keep the house and put them in ward and fed them, but went not in unto them, so they were shut up unto the day of their death, living in widowhood. On the one hand, it's a strange situation because he's asserting his claims as the monarch. He's not blaming the women because they were taken by Absalom on the one hand. On the other hand, he's not going to take them that have been so dishonored. He doesn't blame them. He provides for them for the rest of their lives, but they're no longer, they're treated as if they were widows, in effect. So these are the ones that Absalom had violated, and in broad daylight is a signal that he had taken over the throne. So he wouldn't return these women to the royal harem. Instead, he just provided for them and declared them as widows for the remainder of their life. Now, this action of David has both generous aspects and also tragic aspects, because living in the king's harem, of course, carried with it the possibility of dire consequences as well as luxurious living. So it had it was a sword that cut both ways. These women were confined in order to protect David from further embarrassment or predicament in regard to them. Their recorded right of support because of the violation was perpetrated by Absalom was not initiated in the harem by some harem intrigue and so forth. So it's a strange problem, and that's the way David chose to deal with it. "Then said the king to Amasa, assemble me the men of Judah within 3 days, and be thou here present." This is the guy that David announced would be heir to Joab's job. But he says, okay, assemble me the men within 3 days, and be thou here present. It sounds pretty good, but he wants to bring Sheba to heel is what he's trying to do. Verse 5, "Amasa went to assemble the men of Judah, but he tarried longer than the set time which he had appointed him." Big mistake. Big mistake. There are certain times that are very critical. This is one of them. "And David said to Abishai, now shall Sheba the son of Bichri do us more harm than did Absalom. Take thou thy lord's servants and pursue after him, lest he get him fenced cities and escape us." Amasa, somehow, remember, he's a cousin of Joab, the guy he's going to replace, presumably. It's probable that the men questioned David's right to return to power. He is having a tough time assembling them, on one hand. It might be political, malicious noncompliance. It could be, they have a number of things. In any case, it also could be just the fact that the troops were loyal to Joab and resented the idea that Amasa was going to be put in charge. In any case, leadership is a result of the permission of the governed. And even though it's a military, they still they have ways of dragging their feet. So anyway, we get to verse 6. "Since Amasa did not do what he was supposed to in the appointed time, Abishai, who again is a brother of Joab, he's not the guy in charge, at David's command, took his personal counsel to set out and set out to the north to get the troops together. It's interesting that David still supersedes Joab by giving these orders to Joab's brother in the absence of Amasa. But in any case, Joab, probably with Abishai's consent, is going to take charge. Verse 7. There went out after him Joab's men and the Cherites and the Pelethites and all the mighty men. We'll find out who they are in the next chapter, or in the next couple chapters. And they went out of Jerusalem to pursue after Sheba the son of Bichri. And when they were at the great stone which is in Gibeon, Amasa went before them. But Joab's garment that he had put on was girded unto him, and upon it a girdle with a sword. And he fastened his loins in the sheath thereof, and as he went forth, it fell out. And Joab said to Amasa, "Art thou in health, my brother?" And Joab took Amasa by the beard and with his right hand to kiss him. But Amasa took no heed to the sword that was in Joab's hand. So he smote him therewith in the fifth rib and shed out his bowels to the ground and struck him not again, and he died. And Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued after Sheba, the son of Bichri. So much for military planning. Joab just took charge as a military man just might to do it. And some of the text here is very difficult to properly translate accurately. And so that's why the nature of Joab's treachery is a little hard to understand. Joab, it seems, had a second weapon concealed under his military cloak. He openly wore another sword in its sheath. And he presumably deliberately let the one sword fall, the one that he openly, to set aside any apprehension on Amasa's part. And then, of course, took advantage of that to gain revenge for his loss of rank. Now, what makes this kind of especially heinous is that Joab and Amasa were cousins. And they're in the family. They're they're sons of two of David's half-sisters. And so all of this, again, though, echoes, if you recall, Nathan's prophecy back in 2 Samuel 12. Nathan, when he confronted David over his sin with Bathsheba, he said, "The sword will never depart from your house." So we see constantly the murder of people within the family, one after the other, and this is just another of them. And one of Joab's men stood by him and said, "He that favoreth Joab and he that is for David, let him go after Joab." And Amasa wallowed the blood in the midst of the highway. In other words, everybody's staring at this mess. So when the man saw that all the people stood still, he removed Amasa out of the highway into the field and cast a cloth over him when he saw that everyone that stood came by him stood still. So, it's the same thing like you see on the freeway. When there's an accident on the other lane, everybody stops on both sides, right? Take a look, gawking. So the gawkers are creating a problem. Anyway, that's perhaps a clumsy example, but let's move on. And when he was removed out of the highway, all the people went on after Joab to pursue after Sheba, the son of Bichri. And he went through all the tribes of Israel to Abel and to Beth-Mechah and to all the Berites. And they were gathered together and went also after him. Now, and there's some word issues here I'll spare you in the interest of time. I might mention that the house of Machach is actually a connection with the Syrian kingdom of that name, apparently. It's a location about 12 miles north of Lake Hula, about 4 miles. The geography isn't that important, except it's up there in the north, and that's fine. Let's keep going. Verse 15, "And they came and besieged him and the Abel of Beth-Machach, and they cast up a bank against the city, and it stood in the trench, and all the people that were with Joab battered the wall to throw it down." So thereafter, the whole gang, they've got Sheba's taken refuge there. He's safely ensconced behind the city wall, and he's apparently prepared to face a long siege. So they apparently, what they read, did they end up having, in effect, a mound here where they could enable them to reach the highest point of the wall in order to break down the wall and force an entrance. And this type of warfare, by the way, is all depicted on reliefs of the siege of Lachish. So there's some archaeological background here. But verse 16, "Then cried a wise woman out of the city, 'Hear, hear, I say, I pray you, unto Joab, come near hither that I may speak with thee.' And when he's come near unto her, the woman said, 'Art thou Joab?' He answered, 'I am he.' Then she said unto him, 'Hear the words of thy handmaid.' And he answered, 'I do hear.' Then she spake, saying, 'They were wont to speak in the old time, saying, They shall surely ask counsel at Abel. And so they ended the matter. I am one of them that are peaceable and faithful in Israel. Thou seekest to destroy a city and a mother in Israel?'" That's a use as a figure of speech, by the way. "Why wilt thou swallow up the inheritance of the Lord?" The mother in Israel is a way of speaking of the city as a prominent city in Israel. It's not obvious from the English translation, but that's what the Hebrew. And she's going to go on and suggest that before Joab begin the siege, which is going to cause the whole town to suffer, obviously, he should ask the inhabitants of Abel whether or not they intended to fight for Sheba at his courts. In other words, don't presume that the town's behind Sheba, the fact that he's taking refuge there. The other implication of her remarks here is that Joab should take into consideration the peacefulness and fidelity of the citizens of Abel, not to destroy peace-loving citizens of the members of the nation. You can compare this one with the wise woman of Tekoa that undertook to spare unnecessary bloodshed back earlier and so on. But anyway, let's go ahead here. Far be it from me that I should swallow up or destroy. The matter's not so. A man of the Mount Ephraim, Sheba the son of Bichri by name, hath lifted up his hand against the king, even against David. Deliver him only, and I will depart from the city. And when said unto Joab, behold, his head shall be thrown to thee over the wall. So she's going to get this taken care of. And the woman went unto all the people in her wisdom, and they cut off the head of Sheba the son of Bichri and cast it out to Joab. He blew a trumpet that they retired from the city, every man to his tent, and Joab returned to Jerusalem unto the king. He takes care of that. And now Joab was over all the host of Israel, and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada was over the Chekarites and the Pelahites, which are special troops. And Adoram was over the tribute, and the Jehoshaphat the son of Ahilud was recorder, and Sheba was scribe, and Zadok and Biathar were the priests, and Ira, and also the Jairite, was chief ruler about David. So that's a quick snapshot of it. Strange that Ira the Jairite was David's special minister. He's having succeeded the king's own sons in that capacity. Okay, that brings us to chapter 21. And now we get into some more bloody stuff here. The slaughter and burial of seven of Saul's sons. Verse 1, chapter 21. And there was a famine in the days of David 3 years, year after year. And David inquired of the Lord, and the Lord answered, it is for Saul and his bloody house, because he slew the Gibeonites. This is a strange passage. In Ezekiel 14, it lists the sword, namely war, famine, noisome beasts, pestilence, as four sword judgments of God for the sins of Jerusalem. So the tone here is that this famine that's in the days of David, 3 years, it was recognized, for some reason, that it was a judgment of the Lord. And when they inquired of the Lord answered, it's for Saul. Now one of the problems here is we don't know at what point this actually happened in his reign. It's talked about here. It could have happened earlier. It would seem that this is setting the stage for some things coming, so the chronicler at least places it here. The exact timing of this within David's ministry is a function of academic guesswork. This idea of famine as a judgment, even Solomon will, in some of his writings, refers to a cloudless heaven that could bring famine as a result of the sins of the people. So they, in their mind, had association between this kind of famine or pestilence and the sins of the people at large. Now, in this case, God tells David, this is for Saul. This goes back, Saul, apparently, there's no record of this, we just have to infer that Saul slew the Gibeonites. And so this is requires some further comments. You may recall back in the days of Joshua that he had just destroyed Jericho and Ai, and was about to attack the Amorite Federation in the Canaanite Hill Country. The people of Gibeon, fearing that, you know, they'd heard about the plagues in Egypt, they heard about what happened at Jericho, and the second attack on Ai, they're shook up. So the Gibeonites pull a fast one. They make their clothes look like they've traveled a long way, dusty and dirty and worn out. They make it look like they're visiting from a long distance. So they trick Joshua and his people. And they pretend to be aliens, and therefore they escape the annihilation that was prescribed. And so they trick Joshua into making a covenant with them, whereby they would forever serve Israel in menial tasks, but would never be harmed. That was the deal. Later on, when Joshua finds out that he'd been tricked, he acknowledges that he'd been tricked, but he still regards the covenant as valid, even though they entered into it by trickery. So even though it was done deceitfully, its binding nature was acknowledged, by both the Israelites and, of course, the Gibeonites. So now Saul, apparently, later, years later, in an action that's not recorded in the biblical account, but it's implied by all of this, apparently had killed some Gibeonites during his tenure. And this constituted the breaking of that covenant, in effect. And so even though the covenant was entered, you know, was brought about by deceit, God still holds them accountable. And because Saul killed some of the Gibeonites, this famine is brought. That's not all obvious as you read it quickly. You have to infer, so you have to, you know, connect some of the dots here. So verse 2, the king called the Gibeonites and said unto them, and now the Gibeonites were not the children of Israel, but the remnant of the Amorites, and the children of Israel had sworn to them, this is a recap, and Saul sought to slay them in his zeal to the children of Israel and Judah. Wherefore David said unto the Gibeonites, what shall I do for you? See, David recognizes that A, that was wrong, what Saul did. Furthermore, they have this famine because of that. So David's setting out to try to do, to make it right. David said to the Gibeonites, what shall I do for you? Wherewith shall I make atonement that you may bless the inheritance of the Lord? The Gibeonites said unto him, we will have no silver nor gold of Saul, nor of his house, neither for us shalt thou kill any man in Israel. He said, well, what ye shall say, that will I do for you. And they answered the king, the man that consumed us and that devised against us that we should be destroyed from the remaining in any of the coasts of Israel, let seven men of his sons be delivered unto us. In other words, that man, the man that he's talking about is Saul, of course. Saul's the guy that did the bad deed. So he says, let seven men of his sons be delivered unto us, and we will hang them up unto the Lord in Gibeah of Saul, whom the Lord did choose. And the king said, I will give them. See, they didn't want money. That's where you get the term blood money, by the way, because that can be done in these kinds of situations. But now, one of the questions that scholars wonder, why seven sons? Was it seven Gibeonites that Saul killed? We don't know. That's one possibility. Alternatively, the seven could just be a representative number, which is also used. It's used that way. So, but in any case, the Gibeonites would not be satisfied with anything less than revenge on Saul's house, basically what's going on here. They accused Saul of trying to exterminate them. That was an ancient policy, an attempt to obviate the law of revenge. In other words, if Saul had killed them all, there'd be no problem. The fact that he tried to kill all of them is what's implied. He apparently killed at least seven of them, or at least that seven is used as a representative number, but because he didn't get them all, the rest of them are there to complain and so forth. So in any case, strangely enough, their demands are consistent with the Torah. There's a term for what they're asking for, lex talionitis, which is eye for eye, tooth for tooth. That's that concept, which of course is in the Old Testament, and in Exodus 21, Numbers 35, and so forth. Now, by the way, this idea of blood money, which the whole discussion comes up here behind this, the payment of money by the murderer to the family that was murdered, of the murdered one, is a dangerous precedent because it can be abused by the rich. And the men with money can beat the rap. Now, we, of course, don't have any examples of that in our jurisprudence, do we? Yeah. Okay. Anyway, let me move on here. They decline silver and gold, and they want the seven male descendants of Saul to be given over to them. And the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, because of the Lord's oath that was between them, between David and Jonathan, the son of Saul. But the king took two sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, and whom she bare unto Saul, and Armoni and Mephibosheth, and five sons of Michael, the daughter of Saul, whom she brought up for Adriel, the son of Barzillai, the Meholathite. But there's an interesting problem here, because Rizpah was the concubine of Saul that Ishbeth once accused Abner of having illicit relations with, if you remember back there. In any case, that accusation is what transferred Abner's loyalty to the house of David. You may recall that back in 2 Samuel 3. The sons of Michael, the five sons of Michael here, is a strange problem. You may recall that Michael is said in the scripture to have died childless because of her estrangement with David. Remember her attitude towards David during in his dealings with the priesthood and the Ark of the Covenant strained the relationship between David and Michael. So she died childless, the scripture says. He didn't divorce her, but he assigned her to a special house and had no further marital relations with her. So there's a problem here. Who on earth are the sons here? And the Targum, the Hebrew Targum, suggests that the problem is solved by that Michael raised five sons of her deceased sitter Merab, who Merab had born to Adriel. So That's the way they deal with it. I would, they weren't her sons. They were sons she raised from her deceased sister. Our actual background knowledge is limited here. Anyway, moving on. He delivered them into the hands of the Gibeonites. They hanged them in the hill before the Lord, and they fell all seven together and were put to death in the days of the harvest, in the first days, in the beginning of the barley harvest. So they're publicly executed, in effect, in the early spring. And Rispah, the daughter of Aiah, took sackcloth and spread it for her upon a rock from the beginning of the harvest until the water dropped upon them out of heaven. Remember, there was a famine going on, see? Yeah. And suffered neither the birds of the air to rest on them by day, nor the beasts of the field by night. And was told David what Rispah, the daughter of Aiah, the concubine of Saul, had done. So she was the mother, you see, of the first two that were killed. She refused to take them down and bury them, in effect. And she took cloth, made a tent, and so forth, stood watch from April to October, is really what we're talking about here, until the fall rains came, and she knew that the sin of Saul's household had been expiated, and no further claim would be made on the lives of her family. They linked that famine to the sin. Until the famine's broken by the rainfall, she waited it out, in effect. The fact that the bodies remained there until it rained seems to suggest that God's curse had been on the land, and now the curse rested. Remember in Deuteronomy 21, anyone who's hung on a tree is under God's curse. And of course, that's also applied to the cross. Jesus hung on the cross, enduring our curse. Anyway, the coming of the rain indicated that the curse was ended. Corpses could be taken down and buried and so forth. There's a concept that the body should come down at sundown. That's for a personal crime. As you study the text here, you get into it, it's clear that this is a broader issue. It's not David's sin that we're dealing with. It's his predecessor. It was considered a state crime, if you will. So it has nothing to do with the personal act of murder. But really, it's the violation of a covenant that God is enforcing here, which brought God's displeasure on the whole nation and required vengeance of a public and extended nature. I think that's important for us to understand, because we have a tendency to slip those things under the rug, so to speak. Anyway, David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan the son from the men of Jabesh-Gilead. Remember, that's where they were back, which had stolen them from the street of Beth-shan, where the Philistines had hanged them when the Philistines had slain Saul and Gilboa. We don't know, you know, this all sort of deals with Saul, and David here is trying to make some things right, give them an honorable burial. So he goes, he gets them, he brought them up, verse 13, from thence the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan his son, gathered the bones of them that were hanged. And the bones of Saul and Jonathan's son buried they in the country of Benjamin, in Zillah, in the sepulcher of Kish his father, and they performed all that the king commanded, and after that God was entreated for the land. Some scholars speculate that the devotion of Rizpah is what prompted David to reflect on the whole, what he might do for the bodies of Saul and so forth, and he undertakes this project. One of the things David's doing by this, by the way, in addition to honoring Jonathan, who he loved, he's demonstrating publicly that there's no personal hostility between David and the house of Saul. So he brings their bones from Jabesh-Gilead and bury them properly in their homeland. And so it's obviously a gesture of respect to them, but it's also a very shrewd political move to try to heal the nation. Okay, let's talk a little about the Philistines. Moreover, the Philistines had yet war again with Israel. And David went down, his servants with him, and fought against the Philistines, and David waxed faint. And Ishbi-benob, which was one of the sons of the giant, the weight of whose spear weighed 300 shekels of brass in weight, he being girded with a new sword, thought to have slain David. But Abishai, there he is again. He's quite a number two to Joab, apparently. Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, succored him and smote the Philistine and killed him. And then the men of David sware unto him, saying, thou shalt no more go out with us to battle, that thou quench not the light of Israel. And David shouldn't be that close to hostilities. He's the king, for crying out loud. It came to pass after this that there was again a battle with the Philistines at Gob. And Sibbecai, the Hushathite, slew Saph, which was of the sons of the giant. And there was again a battle in Gob with the Philistines, where Elhanan, the son of some other word I can't pronounce properly, a Bethlehemite, slew the brother of Goliath, the Gittite, the staff of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. And there was yet a battle in Gath, where was a man of great stature, that had on every hand 6 fingers and on every foot 6 toes, 24 in number. And he also was born to the giant. And when he defied Israel, Jonathan, the son of Shimeah, the brother of David, slew him. And these four were born to the giant in Gath and fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants. Now, what you've just encountered in these verses, apparently, is that this guy Goliath, how many of you know the story of David and Goliath? Everybody here? Okay. But most people, remember when David crossed the brook in that time as a kid, he picked up 5 stones. And one of the questions you're going to ask your friends at a Bible study, why did David, when he was facing Goliath, pick up 5 stones? And the answer is, Goliath had 4 brothers. And David was ready for all 5. You see? And because what you find out here in 2 Samuel 21 is that, I forget where the David Goliath, I think it's 1 Samuel, whatever. Anyway, 2 Samuel 21 is that David's men end up finally killing the other sons of the giant, the father. These were Anakim. They were all Arba, and then he had a son by the name of Anak, whose descendants were called Anakim because they were giants. Goliath wasn't the only one. This leads to a corollary topic that I think is important for you to research on your own. Most of you, I think, have been exposed to what we call the angel view of Genesis 6, when these fallen angels try to create a hybrid race that leads to, of course, the flood of Noah. And you need to understand that if you're going to understand the rest of the Old Testament, because what's amazing, in verse 4 of Genesis 6, these Nephilim were then and also after that. In other words, they weren't limited to just before the flood. That's where it was very widespread, and that's why God brought the flood. But we learn that when God tells Abraham that he's going to be gone for 400 years, his descendants will come back after 400 years to the land of Canaan, that gives Satan 4 centuries to lay down a minefield. And apparently, the same kind of thing occurs. You remember when Moses finally, at the Exodus, they get to Kadesh Barnea, he sends in the 12 spies. 2 of them come back with a good report, Joshua and Caleb. Let's go in, let's get them. The other 10, we always disparage the other 10. They say, you know, there's giants in the land. In Numbers 13, verse 33, the word they use is Nephilim, the same word that's used of these creatures, these hybrids, in Genesis 6. How they got there, we don't know. Apparently, it was some of the same kind of mischief by some of Satan's fallen angels. But in any case, they were Nephilim. In fact, the 10 guys are terrified. They said, we are grasshoppers in their sight. We dismissed them as though they're cowards. No, they had reason to be fearful. These guys were, 9 feet tall, whatever. And obviously, Joshua and Caleb were right. They had God on their side. They should have gone forward. Because they didn't, because they trembled before that, and they said, you know, they told Moses, you know, you've brought us out here for us to die. God says, no. With the exception of Joshua and Caleb, everyone else died before they went in. Joshua and Caleb, the only of the old generation, survived. Conquered the land, 7-year conquest, the book of Joshua, you know all that. The point is, what they're against are Rephaim. And I want to talk a little bit about what I'll call post-flood Nephilim. When we speak of Nephilim, that's these fallen ones that are the offspring of the fallen angels and human women. We've often overlooked that Genesis 6 forces also after that. And the word Nephilim is used of these strange occupants of the land of Canaan when they're coming back to take the land. All through the Old Testament, you'll find races of giants. The word Rephaim actually comes from the Hebrew word Repha, which means dead. These are described as if they're walking dead. The Rephaim are a collective term used to this. They live primarily east of the Jordan, according to Deuteronomy 3. They were conquered by Shadr al-Amar in Genesis 14, one of the places they come up. Another variation of them called the Emim. That's what the Moabites call them. It's their term for terrible men, Deuteronomy 2. The Horim are the descendants at Mount Seir prior to the Edomites, apparently, according to Deuteronomy 2. And the Zamsumim, which are the term used by the Ammonites. So whether you're Moabites or Edomites or Ammonites, they use different terms. They're described as different tribes. The Rephaim, the Emim, the Horim, and the Zamsumim. These are creatures that God told Joshua to wipe out every man, woman, and child. And we read that as a New Testament reader, and it shocks us. What's going on here? And remember Bashan, up in Bashan, there's the kingdom of Og. Og was the king of Bashan, the land of the giants in Deuteronomy 3 and Joshua 12 and Joshua 13. This is up in what we call the Golan Heights. And there's Arba, He's a giant. Joshua 14 and 15 and 21. His son is Anak, and he has seven sons called the Anakim. And Goliath and his brothers were descendants of the giant. And of course, Goliath and his four brothers we just talked about. Now, what's interesting is Joshua is instructed to eliminate them. In Joshua 6 and 9 and 10, 11, Deuteronomy 2, 7, it goes all through Scripture. Their failure to do that is very, very instructive, because the areas that they failed to do that were the Golan Heights, a region which today would be Nablus and that central area, and the Gaza Strip. And those are the same areas that are the pockets of the adversaries of Israel to this day. Very, very provocative issue.